Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we explore women's work in early America, known as homespun, and the myths that have grown up around it with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. And we'll be hearing from William Lambers on past attempts to deal with nuclear proliferation, once again a world crisis, and what we might learn from those efforts to control the production of these weapons of mass destruction. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on August 28, 1955, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American from Chicago, was beaten to death in Mississippi for flirting with a white woman. Till was staying with his great-uncle near the small rural town of Money, Mississippi. Before Emmett left Chicago, his mother cautioned him to be careful in the South because of his race. But Emmett did not understand the ferocity and depth of the racial divide in Mississippi, and one day he accepted the dare of his cousins and friends to ask a white woman in a local store for a date. The woman behind the counter was Carol Bryant, the wife of the owner, Roy Bryant, and when Roy returned to the store, his wife told him that Till had grabbed her and wolf-whistled at her. Roy Bryant was outraged. He and his brother-in-law, J.W. Millam, went to Till's great-uncle's house and in the early hours of August 28th, kidnapped Emmett, beat him, forced him to strip, gouged out his eye, strapped part of a cotton gin to his back with barbed wire, and shot him in the head. They threw his body into the Tallahatchie River, where it was found 3 days later. The story made national news, but 2 weeks later an all-white jury found Bryant and Millam not guilty on all charges.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, hundreds of Native Americans recently dedicated the first permanent memorial to the warriors who defeated Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and 260 members of the 7th Cavalry at the Little Bighorn in 1876. American Indians have long complained that the monument that was built there over a century ago did not recognize their ancestors for their victory. The old memorial consists of a hilltop granite obelisk and white headstone. The new monument, erected nearby, consists of a wiry sculpture of Indian warriors, a sunken stone circle, a sacred symbol to many tribes, and an open-air space for tribal ceremonies. The memorial is not about war, said Indian activist Russell Means at the dedication. The last thing you'll remember when you leave us is us. In an update on an item in the news on which we reported a few weeks ago, the inscription on an ancient burial box that purportedly held the bones of Jesus' brother James is a high-tech fake. According to a report issued by Israel's Antiquities Authority, the forger likely used an ossuary reference book to match the ancient Hebrew letters. The letters were probably scanned by computer into a template and then carved by an expert or machine into the stone. It passed initial carbon dating because the forger created a paste from the crumbling outer rock layer of the ossuary, to which was added bits of nearly 2,000-year-old charcoal. This is Talking History.
You're a mystery.
Historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich has written a book about the most commonplace of things, homespun clothing, rugs, and home furnishing. But as she suggests in her conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen, we've much to learn from women's work in early America.
In 1851, the American reformer Horace Bushnell declared that the nation's greatness did not result from the deeds of famous men, but from the heroic work of women at their spinning wheels. To understand the country, one must look at cloth as well as constitutions. My guest, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, a MacArthur Fellow and Professor of History at Harvard University, has done exactly that. Her book, The Age of Homespun, explores the making and meaning of stockings, rugs, tablecloths, and baskets. Her previous book, A Midwife's Tale, received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Ulrich, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're speaking to someone who is not, I believe this is the right word, a textilian. Perhaps you could help us understand exactly what homespun is.
Well, homespun literally is just rough, unfinished cloth. That is, it hasn't been through the fulling mill or it hasn't been dyed or refined in some way. Over time, however, particularly in the United States, it just came to mean homemade rather than, you know, the fancy commercial fabrics that were hand-woven in Europe or the British Isles.
Your book is a study of these kinds of products. I mentioned some of them at the start. Generally speaking, how accomplished was the work of the people who made homespun products?
Well, it varied tremendously. The New England area that I focused on, women were the weavers, and they were informally trained and very part-time. So they didn't make fancy, complex, geometric coverlets like you might find in the Middle Atlantic, where immigrant Scottish or German male weavers produced fabrics. But they came up with some rather fabulous things. New England bed rugs, for example, are a real American innovation, and they often began with a very plain woven, tabby woven, rather rough ground, and then were embroidered, literally covered completely, often with very simple stitches in homespun yarn, but in interesting designs that are really beautiful even today.
I should mention that your book is filled with pictures of the things that you talk about. One of the things that you do examine is a pocketbook made by an 18th century Indian woman, which you say tells a story of intercultural exchange. What is that story?
Well, it's a wonderful, complex story about a woman christened Maria Agate, or known in folklore as Molly Ockett. She was born in central Maine and spent part of her childhood as a refugee in Massachusetts during the French and Indian Wars of the mid-18th century. And then when she returned to Maine, she moved back and forth across borders. She was affiliated with a church, the Catholic parish in Montreal. She became friends with English settlers as they came into central Maine. And her pocketbook is a really wonderful example of the kind of melding of cultures. Pocketbook is a European form. We would think of it as a wallet. I mean, it was to hold money or similar kinds of things. The fabric, however, it goes back to very ancient textile traditions, was made probably from native hemp that had been completely twined in a beautiful geometric pattern using dyed moose hair.
The Industrial Revolution of the 18th century includes things like Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin and advances in power production. That's usually thought to have swept household domestic production aside. Is that what happened?
Well, that's what I thought happened when I began my project. I thought, great, this will end about 1790 or at least by 1800. But to my surprise, I discovered that household production actually expanded with early industrialization. And this was because factory spun cotton warp could be mixed with homegrown flax and kind of speed up and make possible quicker production of home weaving. And the early industrialization also meant the establishment of carding mills, which greatly increased the ease of producing woolen fabrics, carding, the kind of combing to clean and align the fibers of the wool was very, very time-consuming. And when machines took that over, then people increased their sheep raising and they were able to do more spinning and weaving more easily.
It seems to make possible at least a speeding up of certain kinds of production, but the work remains. There's so much knitting going on in your book and embroidering. The work never seems to end. While you make that point, and I suppose it's obvious enough, you have another, for me, more interesting point, and that is that work itself had multiple meanings. The fact that women did so-called domestic work didn't mean that they only worked at home.
Oh, no. That's what is so wonderful about the history of textile production. In Europe, as in America, I mean, you think of all the symbolic meanings of the spinning wheel and the sense of weaving a web, whatever that might be. And in the United States, it certainly had political implications. During the American Revolution, one of the ways of establishing independence from Great Britain is to boycott British manufacturers in the pre-revolutionary period, and that meant creating both the literal and the symbolic value of women's work. And then in the early Republic again, the whole emphasis that somehow the work of women in the home is going to secure a kind of economic independence and a real sort of pastoral economy that would preserve us from some of the negative things associated with industrialization in Europe. Spinning and weaving were also central in what I call the female economy of these early societies. There was a lot of bartering and trading among women from household to household, and women really began to take responsibility for producing a lot of the fabrics that they took into marriage. And so the work literally bound people together, generations, neighborhoods, men's work and women's work as well.
Most of the articles that you examine in your book are successes of one kind or another. At the very least, the job is finished most of the time. So it's interesting, you devote a chapter to an unfinished sock. What could we read into that? Even the person who started it calls it a lack of perseverance.
Oh, right. Well, it's sort of a little metaphor, really, at the end of the book. In part, I suppose, I'm saying this story isn't finished, that we tend to want to do a linear narrative and there are end points, but industrialization didn't end domestic labor or domestic work, so you have mill girls knitting at begging for some homespun yarn from home in order to knit their woolen stockings at the time that they're working in mills and factories for the first time. Beyond that, the unfinished stocking, I think, exemplifies to me the curious way in which New Englanders preserved homely artifacts. And, you know, how did this thing survive? I mean, it's a pretty homely stocking. It's still on the needles. Did it just get left behind by mistake? And then at some point, it sort of became an icon of hard work and household industry and a kind of memorial to somebody who was no longer there. So the very fact that we can study early American textiles is predicated on the notion that they assumed symbolic power and that it was the labor that went into them, not just the finished product. And what you see, of course, in an unfinished object is the labor. You can see it almost in action, a sort of arrested motion.
We're talking here primarily about women and some men also in colonial America and the early Republic. I'm wondering what their idea about work was. It seems that at least two ideas come through in your book. Some see it as an absolute necessity. They measure their life by the work they do. And at the same time, especially for some of the women you talk about, work seems to be an imprisoning thing.
Uh-huh.
Was it liberating or imprisoning?
Well, both. It's easily romanticized. I think there were, particularly for young women who begin to read and read novels, begin to have some aspiration for an education, begin to take themselves seriously. There is a desire to surmount all this seeming constant drudgery and be able to achieve something permanent or lasting in the world. So there's that kind of tension. There's also, I think, a tension between what you're forced to make for yourself and what you might be able to buy at the store. This is a period of expanding consumption throughout the Atlantic world. And one of the things that was fascinating to me as I looked at store accounts and diaries was to see people working extraordinarily hard to make utilitarian fabrics for their households so that they could save what little bit of cash they might have or credit at the store in order to buy a fabric for a calico apron or a bit of lace or sometimes something even more extravagant than that, maybe some copper plate fabric to make a bed curtain. So there isn't a clear distinction between production and consumption in these households. The same people who are making cloth are also purchasing cloth, and these two strands are integrated in the household economy.
Well, there's another interesting conflict or tension here, too. It seems that many of the people want to believe that simplicity, unadorned goods are good, but there's a temptation for ornamentation and refinement.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that mental, maybe it's a moral, tug of war.
Oh, yes. And it, too, develops out of the rhetoric of the revolution that liberty is better than luxury, that, you know, noble people are going to give up these goods coming in by ship in order to secure their freedom from British taxation, British tyranny as they saw it. And so the notion that you might, you know, really want to have these things, teacups, for example, or some kind of fancy fabric or an imported broadcloth, I mean, that becomes politically explosive, and then it begins to carry a kind of moral value as well. And I also think there's a bit of a tension in among generations, young people, you know, wanting things that are new and exciting. And one of the things that fascinated me was to find fairly simple hand-woven linen fabrics embellished with meticulous kind of edgings to make them look more refined so that you could have a nice white tablecloth under your teacups, even if, you know, you're sort of in the mid of the muck and smells of a rural household.
This is the reality that we've been talking about so far, and yet the title of your book comes from a secular sermon of 1851
uh-huh.
that I began with. And from those mid-19th century ideas, you suggest that a myth about homespun emerged, and you call it one of the central myths in American history. Could you elaborate on that? What is that myth of homespun, and what has its significance been?
Well, the myth is there, and it persists even to the present, that somehow people were more virtuous in times past because they were self-sufficient. They had to make everything themselves. They had to rely on themselves, and they had this kind of simple, pastoral, rural life. And those are very old ideas. I mean, you find those ideas in the Bible. You find them in Greek poetry, you find them in the Elizabethan era, but they took on political meanings in the United States through the American Revolution. I mean, we want to believe that our founding is essentially the virtuous, self-sufficient, hard-working, you know, embattled farmer of revolutionary fame. And it is a little surprising when you begin to look at the actual history to see that that supposed self-sufficiency was driven by an expanding Atlantic economy, that from day one people in New England are spinning cotton brought from the slave economy of the West Indies, that the expansion of household production involves the elimination of American Indians and the marginalization of American Indian textiles. I mean, the more you look at this mythology, you see that by focusing on the household and the benign woman sitting at her spinning wheel, you are able to ignore some of the other more troublesome narratives in early American history.
There's a point that you make in your book. Actually, it's first made by Horace Bushnell, the 1851 reformer. He suggests, and it seems to me that you second him in this, that history may be best understood in terms of process rather than events, which would be maybe good news for all those history students who've had dates inflicted on them all the time. In what way is process as important, if not more important, than events?
Well, I think we could use certainly the example that we talked about a minute ago. If you go into a textbook, people memorize Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, for example, and see that as a cause and effect. The invention of a particular artifact leads to an immense transformation in the economy. If you focus not on an event and a date, but you begin to look at a long-term developmental trajectory, you can see that the Industrial Revolution was an evolution in many ways, more than a revolution, and that it was a series of steps, certainly beginning with what some scholars have called the Industrious Revolution, that is, with the expansion of consumer goods stimulating ordinary people to work very hard to produce things in their own communities. And New England's Age of Homespun was part of that Industrious Revolution, which has been largely invisible because of our tendency to focus on, you know, dramatic moments and events.
Well, Professor Ulrich, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, the author of The Age of Homespun, Objects and Stories in the Creation of an American Myth.
For our site of the week, we continue on the subject of women in American history, but we move outside the home to look at the role of women in social movements. Here to tell you about a virtual site where you can study this topic is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Learn about the mid-19th century dress reform movement. To breathe or not to breathe, that is the question, asks a humorous poem in the Water Cure Journal. Or why an appeal on behalf of the freedmen of Washington, D.C. in 1865 provoked anger among freedmen's aid reformers. On this website, you can explore these important social movements and more than 40 others, from moral reform to temperance to age of consent laws. 20th century topics include suffrage, birth control, strikes, and the Equal Rights Amendment, as well as the more recent 1994 Violence Against Women Act. Topics are clearly identified, from African American women and the Chicago World's Fair 1893 to Puerto Rican women, garment workers, and the New Deal. Each project offers an abstract, an introductory essay, and relevant primary materials. Within these projects, the website offers more than 750 documents and 200 photographs covering U.S. history from 1775 to the present. Documents may be browsed by project, date, or subject, and all documents are fully searchable. A teacher's corner provides more than 100 lesson ideas for high school and college teachers. To locate this site, go to historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Dublin, D-U-B-L-I-N, into the keyword search.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week and to William Lambers, who looks at past attempts to control nuclear proliferation. It's the subject in the news as of late, with developments in Korea, India, and Pakistan. But as Lambers suggests, there are precedents for addressing the problem.
India and Pakistan, North Korea, possibly Israel, and now Iran. There is no doubt the Bush administration is facing a nuclear proliferation crisis. Yet to quote one of Bush's predecessors, Dwight D. Eisenhower, if a danger exists in the world, it is a danger shared by all. A multilateral approach is needed to win the struggle against nuclear proliferation. Yet while the prospect of more nations with nuclear weapons is unnerving, it's nothing new. In the early 1960s, it was feared that China possessed nuclear weapons. In 1964, that country tested its first atomic bomb. Other nations were almost certain to follow China's lead and build their own atomic weapon. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson ordered a task force, the Gilpatric Committee, to find a way to stop nuclear proliferation. The committee emphasized the potential domino effect of China's atomic bomb and pointed out that India could be the next to go nuclear, with Pakistan soon following. Sure enough, these predictions were realized, and now South Asia lives in constant danger of nuclear confrontation. Today, Bush administration officials are fearing a similar domino effect. South Korea, Japan, or Taiwan could be forced to develop nuclear weapons in response to North Korea's nuclear threat. Saudi Arabia could do the same in response to an Iranian nuclear weapons program. The Gilpatric Committee recommended a number of multilateral agreements the United States should pursue in the 1960s. Chief among these was a non-proliferation treaty, which was signed in 1968. This treaty sought to halt the spread of nuclear weapons and eventually lead to nuclear disarmament. In addition, the Gilpatric Committee recommended a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty, as well as the establishment of nuclear weapons-free zones. Today, the Bush administration has taken a multilateral approach to resolving the North Korean nuclear issue. But it's clear that more multilateral action is necessary to combat nuclear proliferation worldwide. North Korea officially withdrew from the non-proliferation treaty earlier this year, and the agreement's strength and validity is now in doubt. A comprehensive test ban treaty has not taken effect because 13 nations, including the United States, have failed to ratify it. Nuclear weapons-free zones do not exist in the Middle East or in South Asia, the two most dangerous nuclear regions. Like President Johnson in 1964, President Bush is feeling the heat of a nuclear proliferation crisis. Johnson's response to the nuclear crisis of the 1960s was to support a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, which is still in force today, even though it is always being challenged by nations such as North Korea. The question is, how will President Bush respond to the nuclear crisis facing his administration today? He has succeeded in reaching bilateral agreements, such as the Moscow Treaty of 2002. But will he be able to forge an international consensus to stifle nuclear proliferation and push all the nuclear powers down the path toward disarmament, however long that road may be? The security of the United States and the entire world depends on an effective worldwide nuclear non-proliferation regime. And if it's successful, future generations may not have to tackle this old problem.
You've been listening to Wayne Lambers, author of the book Nuclear Weapons. Lambers' commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments and suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. Our site of the week was produced by Amanda Schumann of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.